Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. Another inland port project has been approved on imperiled Great Salt Lake wetlands. Detecting when students use AI for homework is this school year's newest challenge. Here's how one Utah district is dealing with it. And the Utah Pride Center will not be closing, leaders say, backtracking on an earlier statement. Joining me today, our Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter, Leah Larson. Leah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Culture reporter Palak Jaiswal is with us. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom.
Hello. News columnist Robert Gerke is with us as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we hope to be joined soon by education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. You can join the conversation to upraccess@gmail.com. And let's start with Leah Larson. Leah, here's another inland port story. We've talked a couple times on this program about inland ports. But I keep forgetting, why do we have inland ports? to me, a port is on the ocean, it's on the sea.
Yeah, well, I guess that's why they call it an inland port. The idea of what an inland port is within Utah has kind of evolved over the last year or so. It used to be we were going to build this big transloading facility with rail and trucks in the northwest quadrant of Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City had a lot of concerns about that. There was a lot of protests. And the last year or so, the Inland Port Authority has kind of revised its mission and pivoted its focus to more smaller kind of industrial developments across the state. And instead of what the legislature did in Salt Lake City and kind of forced the port on the city, the Port Authority is now having communities invite them in and kind of, you know, more, it's more of a collaborative effort, I would say. And to answer your question, I guess an inland port, their focus is kind of bringing in more rail, bringing more like industrial manufacturing, kind of blue collar work and good paying jobs. And that's kind of the focus of what they're doing.
Okay. So in this case, Weber County has created an inland port industrial project. So what's the problem?
Yeah. And just to clarify, so Weber County Commission did that first step where they said, we want a port project. So they're inviting the Port Authority in. The Port Authority hasn't signed off on that just yet. But I guess the issue that is being raised by people is that these port projects, not just in Weber County, but, you know, kind of across the Salt Lake Valley, are popping up in some of the last kind of productive habitat for birds and wildlife, some of the last open space on the fringes of the Great Salt Lake. And this one in Weber County is no exception. It is 900 acres right next to the Ogden Bay Wildlife Management Area, which is the second largest managed wetland on the lake after the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge. So it is like directly adjoining that important habitat. And eventually it looks like Weber County wants to expand this industrial development into 6,000 acres. So again, it's just kind of gobbling up all the open space remaining. Because if you think about a bird flying around, they're not like, oh, look, there's a wildlife management area, that's where I'll go and stay. They go onto farmland, they go onto open space. It's all kind of habitat that works together for these migrating birds. So I guess that's the issue that some people are raising.
I'll point out that at sltrib.com, you can find an interactive map, right? Showing, I guess, you can see where these inland ports are, and the fact that many of them are in sensitive areas. Why is that?
Yeah, and that interactive map was not made by us. It was made by the Center for Biological Diversity. So they're one of the most vocal opponents to these port developments. But it is a useful map just to show you how big some of the port projects are and are proposed to be, and just where they kind of overlay wetlands and are kind of on the fringes of wetlands. It's a good question. Why do they keep popping up around wetlands? And the explanation I got from the Port Authority's executive director, Ben Hart, was that back, you know, 150 years ago when we were building Utah and laying down railroad tracks, They kind of went out in the flat parts of the state where there wasn't a lot going on. And that was wetlands. You know, I think our thinking about wetlands has evolved over time, but you know, back then they were just kind of thought of as swampy, useless areas. So they just put a bunch of train tracks through them, I guess. And where the Port Authority is so focused on that train component and getting trucks off the road and some of our cargo and goods loaded onto trains, that is naturally where these areas, I guess, are springing up.
So tell me a little bit more about that. The Port Authority wants to shift more of this to trains and away from trucks. Is that a truck congesting the highway problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think if you've been in Utah for any period of time, it does seem like traffic gets more and more congested. It's just kind of a natural part of a growing state. I don't think we have any proof yet that bringing in these like transloading facilities and rail will actually translate into taking trucks off the road as opposed to just like bringing more trucks as they go to the trains. But, you know, I guess we'll just have to watch all that play out. I don't know that we know for sure yet.
What's the, for example, the Weber County Commission, that they're wanting this. Is this economic development? Is that why they want this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what all these communities want in bringing these port projects in. And it's an understandable thing. You know, they want to grow their communities. They want to provide good paying jobs. They want to diversify their tax base. They want to create affordable housing, all those good things. You know, I think they're well-intentioned, of course. So I think that's the motivation behind it. And, you know, I think it's important to say that whether or not the Port Authority gets involved, these areas are already kind of slated for industrial development anyway. The Inland Port Authority just kind of provides, you know, like money and expertise to help them develop. And the Port Authority would argue, I believe, that they can kind of provide incentives that these communities preserve things like wetlands and introduce environmental protections that maybe they otherwise wouldn't prioritize if they were just undertaking it alone.
I believe the Inland Port, they've talked about the environmental aspect of this, right? I guess they're saying they're trying to persuade the development to be more environmentally friendly. Do they have any power to force such development?
That's a good question. Yeah, so the executive director, Ben Hart, you know, when I talked to him, he is very passionate about wanting to develop these in the right way for communities and protecting the environment and protecting wetlands. And what they sort of have is, so once a property is developed with, you know, a manufacturing facility or a warehouse or something, the value of that property goes up, right? So the tax, the property tax also goes up that the county would be taking in. But what the Port Authority does is it takes that tax increment or a portion of it and uses that money to create incentives to lure certain companies and to incentivize companies to, you know, maybe preserve this wetland over here, or maybe, you know, change your lighting so it's better for wildlife and it's not like glaring into the sky, distracting birds, that kind of thing. But yes, to your point, they have no enforcement. They have no teeth, right? All they can do is provide, you know, like that carrot instead of the stick, I think is what they like to say.
Meantime, what are environmentalists saying? The Center for Biological Diversity, what are they saying?
Well, I think they're very troubled about the loss of open space and about the proximity to wetlands because we have lost an astonishing amount of wetlands over time. And the Great Salt Lake has some of Utah's best and last remaining functional wetlands. It's a problem across the West, especially with this drought. We're just, you know, wetlands are disappearing and these vital ecosystems that aren't just good for birds, they're good for people too. They absorb flood water, they filter water and take pollutants out of our water and improve water quality. So they have all kinds of benefits. And they're, you know, once you pave them over, it's really hard to, you know, like rebuild them somewhere else or bring them back. So I think that is their primary concern.
I guess another value of wetlands, they absorb and buffer your riding impacts from flooding.
Yeah, which, you know, we saw take place this year with our massive spring runoff. That Ogden Bay Wildlife Management Area I mentioned absorbed a lot of that runoff that would otherwise be, you know, flooding our communities or our businesses. So I think that's another issue actually with development so close to wetlands is you're kind of paving over all the space, all that water has to go, if that makes sense, and kind of dissipate. So we'll see if that causes flooding issues down the road.
You write in your story that state lawmakers did earmark nearly $500 million in conservation efforts around the Great Salt Lake. Can any of that go to save these wetlands or mitigate these port projects?
Yeah, that's a good point. It was actually $10 million that this new Great Salt Lake Trust that lawmakers formed a couple years ago. So they set aside $10 million for wetland protection. And, you know, I think opponents to the port projects would argue that this seems pretty contradictory, that on the one hand, the state's giving money to wetland protection. And then on the other hand, we have this quasi-state governmental organization, the Port Authority, giving developers a bunch of money to pave over the wetlands. Yeah, so I'm not really sure how those two are going to play out. Again, that's a thing that I guess we'll just have to watch and see. But yeah, I mean, the state has signaled that it finds the lake important and that it wants to protect it. And I think there's a growing understanding, especially with the lake hitting a record low. So we'll see how it all plays out.
You write there's recently a protest on Capitol Hill about this.
Yeah, there have been a lot of protests about the Port Authority. Not quite as rambunctious as they used to be when the Port Authority was initially formed and Salt Lake City was super opposed. But yeah, I mean, there's still a vocal group of people raising concerns about this and are frequently up on the Capitol and at the Port Authority board meetings voicing their concerns.
The governor recently talked about this. What did he say?
Yeah, so he was at his monthly press hearing. He did. He was asked about why you support the Port Authority when you are saying that Great Salt Lake protections are so important. And I think he basically just said that he has confidence in the Port Authority and its leadership, and that it's going to be quote unquote the greenest inland port in the nation. Which I don't think that. I mean, that's kind of not a hard bar to pass. Like, I don't think there's any green inland ports or ports. You know, I thought, how do we define what a green inland port is or an environmentally inland port, friendly inland port is? The fact is that bringing a bunch of diesel trucks and trains, like they're going to have an environmental impact. Paving over open space will have an environmental impact. Of course, these can be mitigated to an extent, but there are environmental trade-offs.
You remind us at the end of your story about the dangers, I guess, to the Great Salt Lake, and I don't know if you could put it this way: who the biggest offenders are? Maybe that's a bad way to put it, but what are the biggest factors in threatening the lake?
Yeah, so the Great Salt Lake Strike Team issued a report earlier this year that looked at, like, why is the Great Salt Lake shrinking? Who is to blame here? And, I think a lot of people just look at the drought in the West and they're like, well, clearly it's the drought and it's climate change. But no, in fact, it is us. It is people. Our consumption, our water use, and our water habits account for 73% of the lake's current decline. So really the best and most effective way to save the lake is to change our habits.
All right. Well, thank you for reporting on this. I want to talk about another story of yours, but first I want to get Robert Gerke's comments on this story. Robert, what do you think?
This one feels a little different to me than the original inland port. You know, it's something that the residents of the community want. And so whether they do it as a quote unquote inland port, or it's just done sort of in a piecemeal basis, there is this issue though of encroachment on wetlands that is been a constant struggle, I think, in this entire area surrounding the Great Salt Lake. I mean, one of the premier wetlands areas in the country, the migratory bird habitat, etc. And so, it's about finding a balance. And I'm not sure that from what I'm hearing in this story, I'm not sure that there's really that search for this balance. I'm not sure we're hitting it right. And so, it'll continue to play itself out. But, once you lose the wetlands, they're gone. So that's got to be one of those things that is front of mind as this project develops.
So, Leah, you had a story also this week about restoration of a river in the small community of Helper. So remind us where Helper is.
Yeah, so Helper is about halfway between Salt Lake City and Moab. When you go through that canyon in Spanish Fork and you pop out on the other side, you're essentially in Helper.
We're talking about the Price River here. Describe the river before this project and after.
Yeah, so this river, like a lot of rivers in arid Utah, has just been like diverted to like every last drop tapped, used for agriculture, cities around Price, a little mining as well. Through Helper, it had all these diversion structures that farmers had put in, these big concrete barriers to move water out of the river and get it to their fields. And then a few years later, these farmers decided to consolidate and just put one big diversion structure upstream, but they didn't take out the old ones. So they were still in the river, kind of blocking fish from swimming upstream and moving down the stream and spawning and the things that fish like to do. A barrier to people who maybe want a boat or go fishing. So it was, kind of a mess, like a lot of rivers as they've been developed. But the Helper came together and decided that they wanted to take those barriers out and make the river run free again.
Where'd the funding come from? I think this was, at least some of it was private funding.
Yeah, so their mayor is just like really good at writing grants, I guess. Like she's secured all this money to beautify their downtown and replace like all their old water infrastructure, all their old pipes and things and their sewer lines. So she's just like a whiz at getting grants. So yeah, she got some private funding. She got some funding from the bipartisan infrastructure law, some funding from the state chipped in some money, and then Trout Unlimited was a big partner in helping her get some money as well to help improve about 7 miles of the river.
Hmm. The mayor says that, quoting her, Helper was practically a ghost town by 2012. I guess there is an ongoing revitalization.
Yeah, there is. So historically, Helper, it was kind of a rail town and a mining town, and both those industries kind of went into decline. And so they had to pivot and rethink their economy and what they wanted to be. And they've kind of developed into this artsy community with just kind of this vibrant downtown. They're famous for their annual arts festival, which was a couple weeks ago. Kind of a fun place to check out if you've never been, in large part due to this effort to revitalize the community.
Yeah, I'll put in a plug for Carbon County, Helper, Price area, the beautiful area there.
Very, yeah.
So interesting part of your story. The mayor also said that at least part of this river had been restored by the time the pandemic hit, and it became important to residents that the river did.
Yeah, I think we kind of tried to memory hole the pandemic to an extent, but if you think back to lockdowns, like we all had a social distance. And so a lot of us spent time outside, kind of what we did to preserve our sanity, and the same was true in Helper. I guess people went outside and were trying to find things to do, and they rediscovered their river. They were tubing it, they were fishing it. And the mayor said to her that was sort of an aha moment that, this money and this effort they were putting into repairing the river was paying off, and it was turning into a quite the community asset.
I think Trout Unlimited was involved here.
They were. They helped secure some of that money. They helped find engineers to design what they were going to do with the river and restore the floodplains. And yeah, they were definitely a very involved partner.
And to put a bow on this, I think you're right that the program came in under budget.
Yeah, like way under budget, which never happens, right? Yeah, they thought it would cost $6 million, and it came in at about $3.5 million, according to Trout Unlimited. So good job, Helper.
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely visit Helper. If you're coming from the Uinta Basin, good luck, because all the oil trucks are using Indian Canyon. But if you're coming in from elsewhere, Helper is a great place to visit. Thanks, Leah. Appreciate that.
Sure.
Robert, anything you want to say on that story?
I echo your sentiments about Helper. I think it's a great little town. Very quaint, has a lot going for it. It's one of those towns that's kind of on the rise, I think. And so these rivers we have in our state, it's kind of a symptomatic thing where they've been used and used and used, and now they're being sort of realized as these gems that they are and being restored and recovered. And so I think that I'm happy to see it And it was a nice story that Leah did. Good job.
Yeah, nice success story there. Well, let's head toward a break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Palak Jaiswal about the Utah Pride Center, some financial problems there. And if we have some time, I'd love to talk about her story about problems our letter carriers are facing with the heat. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We turn next to culture reporter Palak Jaiswal. Palak, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
So you had a couple stories on the Utah Pride Center, and the headline is Utah Pride Center won't be closing, leaders say, backtracking on an earlier statement. So what did they say earlier that they're backtracking on?
Right. So I guess a bit of history. This started the previous week, where the Pride Center had posted a statement on their social media accounts, on Instagram, and also in an email newsletter. In that first statement, they kind of admitted to, quote, massive financial turmoil. And they talked about, because of this turmoil, there is a chance that the Pride Center might close, revive, or reset. And that was also a quote from that story. And so this original statement was posted and then promptly deleted a couple of minutes later. And we were able to catch it, but that happened a week ago. And then there was no word from the Pride Center. And then this Wednesday night, they posted a new statement saying they will not be closing, just that they will be shut down in September and all of their services will be shut down as they kind of recalibrate.
So tell us why the need for recalibration. I guess there are, as far as we can tell, financial problems at the Pride Center.
Right. The Pride Center didn't respond to any of my requests for comment, so I'm not exactly sure what is going on here, except for what they said, you know, in their statements, which was essentially that they have had massive financial issues. Now, we have a history kind of reporting at the Tribune from other reporters on staff, and also actually a column from Gerke about this year's Pride Festival and how much it cost. It was very expensive from what we're understanding. Gerke's column, you know, detailed a total of over $300,000 just in $300,000 in security costs. So my understanding is that it has been very expensive, the Pride Festival itself. There has kind of been an ongoing history at the Pride Center of financial problems and dissatisfaction from former employees. And so there's a lot of history here, but not a lot of answers as to what is currently happening, except kind of blanket statements from the Pride Center, like there is no question that the Utah Pride Center is currently facing financial struggles.
And I think from reading your stories, the Pride Festival is important, right? In the mix for income. And I guess COVID hit, where they had to scale it back or cancel, and costs are going up, I guess. So that's maybe part of the financial turmoil.
Yeah. And another criticism of this year's Pride Festival that our reporter Colby Peterson reported on was, you know, local artisans and makers in the community were priced out of having booths at the Pride Festival. And so there has been this kind of criticism that the Pride Festival has abandoned the local community in a way, or has just not listened to the needs of the local community. But the Pride Festival, I think it's fair to say, you know, it's the Pride Center's main fundraising aspect. And so it's kind of a hard, complicated thing to balance. And so, you know, in that first statement that the Pride Center posted, they asked for, you know, feedback from people in the community. And then they deleted the statement. But the second statement, they did the same thing. They asked for feedback. And in the comments, at least on that Instagram post, you can see community members leaving feedback. So it's a bit of a complicated story.
Yeah, it certainly is. So I guess what we know at this point is they're going to be evaluating. Are they looking for a new director? What's going on there?
Yeah. So this also, we should note that the first story we did, the first statement that the Pride Center put out, that was after Q Salt Lake Magazine's Michael Aaron did a story on them laying off some of their staff members. And so this is a credit to Michael Aaron and his reporting. But in that original statement, they had noted that, we have massive financial turmoil. We're going to shut down all of our programs for the month of September and recalibrate. And then in this new statement, they had asked feedback from the community to come to this email address, which I think is executive director@pridecenter.org, if I'm remembering correctly. But we found a job application posted within the last week on Indeed.com for an executive director position opening at the Pride Center, which would pay between $77,000 and $150,000. So it's kind of unclear, again, as to what is happening here. The Pride Center did not respond to comment, and the statement, the second statement that's still up, is signed by Tanya Hawkins, who is listed as the remaining CEO. So it's a little bit complicated. We're not exactly sure what's going on. So we're kind of just going off what we can find.
And I believe, according to your reporting, there are some businesses that are willing to open their doors, provide space.
Yes. I think that's been kind of a bright light maybe in all this entire situation. A lot of local LGBTQ businesses, own businesses and spaces are opening up their businesses for people to come and, you know, gather, or if there were certain groups at the Pride Center that have, you know, don't have access to go anywhere. There's Under the Umbrella Bookstore, the Legendarium Bookstore, Sugar House Coffee, and Club Verse as well. They have all put out statements about opening their doors and being a place of support for the community. So it'll be interesting to watch what happens next over the course of this next month, and then into early October.
Well, thank you for reporting on this, Sipalik. Stay tuned here. I want to talk to you about another story that you have. But I want to turn to Robert Gerke. What do you think about this story?
Well, I mean, it's happened with other nonprofits in the past, but it's hard to see them kind of go through these I don't know, not growing pains, I guess shrinking pains. I'm hopeful. I hope that they get their hands around this issue, and it appears that there's been some fiscal mismanagement. There needs to be some accountability brought in. And it's not just the Pride Parade, the Pride Festival that they do. They do projects all year round, and so they're valuable to the community, and hopefully they get the management issues resolved, because unfortunately, once you get underwater, once an organization like this gets underwater like this, it's hard to pull their way up. But we need every community needs an organization like this, and the LGBTQ community is no exception. And so I guess fingers crossed. We'll watch and see how it goes. And if they aren't able to make it, from what Palak was saying, there are other businesses and there's a network of people who are willing to kind of step in and take over that role, I think. So it's unfortunate, but these things happen sometimes, and we'll watch and see how it plays out.
In the meantime, you can see the reporting at sltrib.com. Palak Jaiswal, I want to talk briefly about another story you had. You talked to some letter carriers. It's been hot. And these are some folks that are out in the elements. What are these letter carriers saying?
Yes, it has been very hot, as I'm sure everyone can attest to, but I think especially these letter carriers. I was able to talk to two who are based in St. George, so extra, extra hot for them. One of them was Rich Dyer, who is 65 years old. He has 692 addresses on his route, which comes up to around 620 physical stops that he makes 6 days a week in a truck with no air conditioning. And this is also the second summer in a row that he's dealt with heat-related illness. He was actually advised by his doctor to take time off because he has other medical things that he takes care of, but also just a lot of it was exacerbated by the heat. So he was being, you know, he felt dizzy and dehydrated and stuff. And unfortunately, his case is not unique in the sense that it's happening across the country. There, we detail kind of in the story that in Texas, postal workers rallied in San Antonio earlier this month for better working conditions. In a Dallas suburb, a letter carrier actually died in June of a suspected heat-related illness. And so it's something that happens across the country. And you know, while reporting this story, I kind of realized that there's not a lot of solutions in place, at least, that are happening very quickly. So yeah, it's an interesting story.
Did you talk to the Postal Service? What are they saying?
I did. I got a statement from the Postal Service in the story, and they essentially just said that, you know, we value our employees and their safety, and we encourage them to stay hydrated. But, you know, I also talked to labor union representatives in the state of Utah, and they, one of them, Phil Rodriguez, says that that kind of response and the program that the USPS has in place doesn't really do anything to help carriers. You know, it's kind of a, you know, keep yourself hydrated. If you feel like you are getting heat-related illnesses, you know, stop working, but there's no real precautions in place. And so another interesting aspect is I found out in this story was that people have kind of developed their own like tips and tricks, so to say, of how to stay safe. So the other letter carrier I talked to said that when he was in charge of a labor union, he would encourage the employees to like pull over to a gas station, buy a Gatorade, and stand in the beer cooler for 10 to 15 minutes until they cooled off. So it's, you know, we should note here that the USPS is rolling out air conditioned trucks, but it's happening very slowly. And, the labor union representatives here in Utah say that it's going to be a while until Utah sees fully air conditioned trucks everywhere, because we're considered a smaller state in comparison with, say, Texas or California. So, I mean, it's kind of brutal.
Yeah. And these letter carriers were telling you that they're not really any 8-hour days. They're longer days, right? And pressure to deliver. Anything you want to say on that? And then one of them was saying that the people he delivers to are not just customers. He remembers birthdays. People invite him over for Thanksgiving.
Yeah. So there's no quota when it comes to how much letter carriers have to deliver, but there is kind of this pressure expectation that they have to meet all of their deadlines, so to say, right? And however long it takes to meet those deadlines, that's how long they're working. And there's also a lot of this stems back to they're understaffed. They've been understaffed since COVID. And so everyone is still trying to deliver and do their jobs. And Phil Rodriguez, the labor union representative, he had a really good quote in the story where he said, you know, it's been this way for probably 5 years, and I'm not hopeful that it's going to get better. But the same letter carrier we started the story with, Rich Dyer, I had asked him kind of like, what brings you joy about this job if, you know, you're working in kind of unsafe or, you know, brutal conditions every day? And he was like, you know, I've been doing this for so long that all the people on my route, they're my friends. You know, I asked him if he gets chased by any dogs, right? Because that's kind of like a cultural thing that we joke about. And he said, no, I carry a box of dog biscuits. And he goes to some of his customers' Thanksgiving celebrations. They invite him every year. He knows their kids' birthdays. And, you know, it's not just a relationship where he's dropping off the mail and leaving. You know, people come out and they talk to him and they're friends with him. And it was a really heartwarming way to end a kind of crappy story, I guess, in the sense that, you know, they're going through all these things.
Yeah, thanks for reporting on that. You can find that at sltrip.com. Thanks, Pollock. Robert Gerke, anything you'd like to say on this story?
You know, I mean, letter carriers has always been one of those jobs that's fascinated me for this reason. I mean, because, like, yeah, you're out there in the heat, in the winter, you're out there in the cold. You know, they're not unique in a sense, I guess, that they're, you know, like construction workers, landscapers, things like that, who also have similar challenges. But I think it's important that they're taken care of, that they're not, you know, they shouldn't be putting their life on the line working in this heat without the necessary, you know, accommodation. So hopefully they get those trucks rolled out soon. And, you know, if you think about it next time you see your letter carrier, I guess thank them for what they're doing for you.
Certainly true. Let's head toward a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. Following a break, we will talk about AI, ChatGPT, and other generative AI software, and how that's hitting K-12 schools. It's quite the conundrum. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We turn next to education reporter Carmen Nesbitt. Carmen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom. Of course.
Good morning. I understand you've had power went out and a bunch of problems at your place. So thanks for overcoming those and being with us. So we want to talk about AI. I'll just read your first sentence in the story. As Utah kicks off a new school year, educators are less stressed about students resorting to the dog ate my homework excuses. Their more pressing worry is that a chatbot did the homework. So, you know, we're all dealing with AI and ChatGPT. K-12 school would be, I could imagine, a place where you'd have to really deal with this. You're looking at Provo School District, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's not just Provo schools, but I think every district in the state and the country and the world is going to have to address this issue, specifically with ChatGPT. I don't know if you've ever used it, Tom, but you can literally tell it to write an essay about George Washington as if a third grader wrote it, and it'll produce. That's what teachers are concerned about. But they also have to kind of acknowledge that kids are going to use this technology. There's no getting around it. And Susie Cox, she's the director of innovative learning at Provo Schools. And she said it's not sensible, is what her quote was, to send home an assignment and expect that at least some of it wasn't used or wasn't crafted with the help of AI. So districts are now asking themselves, well, how do we use this technology then? What are ethical ways to implement this in the classroom and outside of the classroom? And there's actually quite a few concerns that I didn't even think about, you know, districts having to consider.
I hadn't either until I read your story. By the way, a lot of districts, I think, banned the technology originally, and now they're coming up with policies to deal with it. Cox was saying that it's going to be with us, right? Plus, these students are going to need to, it'll be valuable for them in their careers, perhaps, and so we need to embrace it.
Right. Yeah, she compared it to the, like in agriculture, when the tractor was developed, like we're not going back. We're not going back to the hoe. We're not going back to this manual labor. This is a new technology. This is transforming how we do things. And yes, like you said, many of the districts decided to ban it, kids were still getting around it. And likely those kids were also from families who have multiple devices at the home. So they could set aside their school-issued laptop and get on their personal laptop and still use ChatGPT. But other students don't have the luxury of having extra devices at home. And that's one of the things they have to consider when writing a policy about AI.
So this is the equity problem, right? Some kids have access to technology, some don't. How are they thinking they're going to attack that problem?
They don't have answers to that yet. Mm-hmm. A Provo school board member did ask, well, what are we going to do? Like, if we can't be naive and say that no one is going to use it, but we also have to know that other students can't use it, what do we do? And the answer was, I don't know. There's no answer, good answer for that yet, or good solution for that yet. One solution, however, because this is also something that they have to consider, is student privacy. So any educational record is protected under the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which basically says that the public does not have access to student records. So anything done on ChatGPT for a homework assignment, for example, would be a student record. And ChatGPT does not have any data privacy agreements with the state or the district, nor will it ever. So essentially, even if they were to say, yeah, we'll allow we'll allow students to use chatbots to do homework, parents still have to sign off on that because it's a privacy issue. So that again creates an inequity because a parent might not sign off on a student being allowed to use a chatbot because of that privacy issue. And there is not yet, and I'm sure there will be soon, a chatbot that has that level of data protection that classrooms or that school district could use.
Now, what if
I'm sure it'll be developed.
Yeah, I'm sure this technology is moving so fast. So what if we want to, I'll ask it this way, is there any software that could detect that a student has used a chatbot for their homework?
Yes, there is, but the ones that exist are not particularly effective. Provo Schools is considering a program called CopyLeaks. And on its website, it does claim that it is 99.1% accurate. I did play around with it, though. It does give you kind of a little, like, preview. And I put in something I wrote that I knew I wrote that I had not got from AI. And it still said it was from AI, or it detected AI use. And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe the not free version works a little bit better, but but even Susie Cox said that it's not exactly accurate, and it'll come back with saying something like, oh, maybe 10% of this, you know, essay was written using AI. And then the teacher has to go to the student and say, hey, this software said you used AI, and the student can just say, well, no, I didn't. And then it becomes, you know, the student's word against the software's word. So it's still not quite there where districts need it to be.
Finally, if we're going to embrace this and that students are going to use this in their classroom, which I think Cox is saying we should, how is she suggesting that teachers use this?
Well, she's suggesting for teachers, it can kind of lessen the workload, right? So there's nothing saying that teachers personally can't use it to generate, you know, lesson plan ideas or assist with everyday tasks. And it can be used as an instructional tool. So she's kind of recommending at this stage, teachers use that to help with their load, right? But also kind of coming to terms with the fact that it's going to impact the way that every teacher teaches, right? It's going to change the field permanently. And we just don't know how that is going to be yet, but It's going to happen, and that there has to be some sort of, you know, realization of that among teachers.
A fascinating story. I'm sure you'll be following up on this as we go along. Carmen Nesbitt, thank you so much.
Of course.
Robert Gerke, what do you think about this one?
Yeah, it's the same issue that is being dealt with all across the country and in all sorts of walks of life. I mean, AI is not going away. It's a tool that people are finding ways to use in there. But, you know, when you're talking about education, I mean, these are issues that have been out there in education for a long time. You know, whether you're when I was a kid, you were copying out of an encyclopedia, or, you know, you're copying it off a website later on. There's websites that solve math problems for you. And now there's these things that generate essays. I mean, I think part of the solution is do more in person, you know, where you're writing the essay in class or solving the math problem in class, so you're not using AI. So there's not the opportunity to use it, but it's not going away. And then you've also got to, I think, emphasize, it's an opportunity, I guess, in some ways to emphasize to these kids that, you know, there's ethical considerations and things like that they need to take into account when they're, you know, cheating is wrong, whether, no matter how you do it. But yeah, it's a problem that's going to be ongoing and probably increasing and growing, not just in education and professional work and everything else, for the years to come. So we are trying, as always, to try to get our heads around the newest technology, and it's always going to be a struggle.
Let's head toward our underplayed stories of the week. I was going to have you talk a little bit, if we have time at the very end, Robert, have you talk about this legislature brought a shotgun to a water fight, that your column. But let's do underplayed stories of the week. Let's start with Leah Larson. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Sorry, couldn't get to my unmute button fast enough. So my underplayed story is about the Hoberman Arch, which was this cool art sculpture that featured heavily in the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City. And it has since been relocated to the airport, which was not as easy of a feat as you might expect. So check out the story on sltrib.com to see why.
All right, sltrib.com. Let's go to Palak Jaiswal. What's your underplayed story of the week?
My underplayed story of the week is from Christian Martinez through our Amplify Utah program, which helps elevate local media, student journalism in local media. And he did a story on a series of anti-LGBTQ flyers seen around the Slick Community College campus during Pride Month, and kind of how it sparked a discussion at the college and what the response was. It's a really interesting story.
That is an interesting story. SLTrip.com for that one. Carmen Nesbitt, what's your underplayed story of the week?
So this is actually kind of an older one, but it's a story from Megan Banta. She's our data reporter, and she talks about how the pandemic grants are running out that were previously helping daycare businesses. And this could have come up on your show before, but... they're drying up in October, and parents have no way to pay for those extra costs. That was a really good article.
It was, yeah. SLTrib.com for that one. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, if you like, I can just drop it quick.
Yeah, just tell us about this.
So there, this originated, this was last week. There was this meeting between... There was supposed to be just supporters of this dam project in Hatch, Utah. The people in Garfield County want to build a dam, create a reservoir there so they can retain some of the water for that they use for agriculture and also have potential recreational opportunities. This state legislator, Carl Albrecht, tried to get supporters together, but the opponents of this dam, everybody who lives downriver basically from this, who uses the water for irrigation and so forth, found out about it, and they went down to, participate in the meeting. It wasn't a protest. They just wanted to be there with the state officials and the supporters of the dam to, you know, give their two cents. And Representative Albrecht, when they showed up, he said, well, if you're going to stay, I guess I better go to my car and get my shotgun. Comes back in with his shotgun, you know, it's open, it's not loaded necessarily, so he puts it on the table. But it was just, you know, he said he was just injecting some humor into the, you know, trying to bring some levity to it, saying, you know, in the West, you know, people get shot for over water disputes. The opponents of this project didn't really see it that way. They thought it was maybe intimidating, not really, you know, it was at least in poor taste. One guy called it bull, you know, S, saying, you know, we're not going to start bringing pistols to water meetings. But it was just it was an interesting tactic. It didn't solve the issue, obviously. I mean, it's intractable. There's the people downstream don't want to give up their water, and the people upstream, you know, still want their dam, but there's no water to put in it at this point. So anyway, it was just an interesting, you know, and the Democrats came out with a statement yesterday that I think is kind of on point, that, you know, if this is what Governor Cox is talking about when he says disagree better, I think we're doing it wrong. So
yeah, that's an interesting story. You can find that at sltrib.com, all of Robert's columns as well. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. Hope you'll be with us next time.